Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, September 10th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County Legislator Mark Grimm, and Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead Anna Markowitz.
Let's go to our stories for today. And really, I want to talk about the Supreme Court and a pair of stories, and we can separate these, although I'm going to kind of mush them together in the beginning, and then we can take them apart and look at them in their own. First of all, we want to talk about the fact that the Supreme Court is going to weigh the legality of Trump's tariffs in an economic case. The Supreme Court announced that it will quickly weigh the legality of most of President Trump's sweeping tariffs, a far-reaching case that could determine the fate of a cornerstone of the president's agenda and alter the course of the U.S. economy and global trade. The justices asked the government and a group of small businesses and states to expedite briefings in the case, setting a deadline of September 19th, which is not far away, as it is only September 10th now, to submit them. The case has been set for argument the first week in November. So this is definitely being fast-tracked. The Trump administration asked the justices last week to quickly overturn a split decision by a federal appeals court that ruled the president could not impose the import taxes under a 1977 law that grants him emergency powers over the economy. The tariffs have been the central feature of the tumultuous trade war that has defined Trump's second term, creating wide-ranging and unpredictable efforts for businesses and consumers alike, as the president has repeatedly announced, then paused or modified levies on goods from other nations. Trump has argued tariffs will help end the fentanyl crisis, rebuild American manufacturing, and save jobs, but the moves have unsettled investors and stoked concerns about the U.S. economy and inflation. That reporting from the Washington Post. The other, so we'll talk about that, and then there is the story of the Chief Justice acting on his own and issuing an administrative stay, pausing a trial judge's ruling while the full court considers the matter. Will that on foreign aid? We'll get into that in just a few moments. But when it comes to the tariff case, Bob Griffin, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, the tariff case is interesting on a couple of different levels. To me, is it really comes down to the court better defining what the emergency powers of the president are. I have felt for a long time that the president has misused his emergency powers, and that the power to implement the tariff system that he wants really belongs with Congress. And I think this is part of the story of if Congress isn't going to stand up for its powers, will the court? My bigger concern is the president is more than willing to use and frankly abuse executive power. But I'll go back to a real basic premise, Joe, is that the powers of Congress aren't Congress's, they're the people's. And the fact that Speaker Johnson and the majority leader Thune are not standing up for the rights of Congress, the rights and responsibilities of Congress, I think is a real problem. Back to the court. In my mind it's a hard leap to link tariffs and fentanyl. It strikes me as that you could cherry pick almost anything and say it's an emergency and therefore I should be able to use emergency powers. I think it's almost laughable to be able to for the government to be saying that somehow the the tariffs are linked with, you know, the overall economy, given what's happening in the crashing basically of the economy. I will say again my concern about the court, on the court itself, its role that it has in, frankly, reshaping policy, reshaping laws. I think it has gone too far in frankly in interpreting on its own what policy should be, and frankly is going to go down in history as one of the worst courts that we've seen. With that said, you know, Joe, in a very weird way, SCOTUS, the Supreme Court ruling against Trump might be the saving grace for Trump and the GOP right now, because it gets them out of the morass that they are now in with tariffs and what it's doing to the overall economy. So there's this perverse, there's almost sort of perverse incentive for them to rule against Trump right now, because it may be the only saving grace for the economy.
Anna Markowitz.
I mean, I think it's particularly rich to use a emergency order on the economy when we're at an all-time high in the stock market. We have unemployment that's at historic lows. It's a blatant power grab, just like a lot of his other emergency executive orders. And I would love to see the Supreme Court, you know, have a backbone on this. But I think that I had hopes that it would on many other rulings up to the state. And I've been disappointed every time. They have stripped protections for migrants who are trying to escape war. I am not hopeful, and I think it could be really actually devastating to the economy. It's weird that he's using an executive order to save the economy when it's already good and might be imposing actions that will actually tank the economy. But here we are.
I hate for this to be self-indulgent. During the lockbox introduction of both Sarah and Ray, they were talking about the broadcast that we did from Lake Placid. And the second hour, 10 to 11, that we did was on trading with Canada, cross-border trade, and the impact not only on Canada but on the United States. And if you did not hear that and see what impact it's having, I think it's really interesting to hear people from all sides talk about just how devastating that has been in the very short term, and quite concerned as to what it could mean for the long term. Mark Grimm.
Yes. Well, first of all, this isn't about whether tariffs are a good idea or not. That's not what the court is being asked to decide. They're being asked to decide what the level of authority is for the president and the Congress. And one thing presidents have in common, Democrat or Republican, is they all want more influence. But you know what? Congress is the same way. So our system is based on having the Supreme Court make the ultimate decision. My concern is with lower courts, who are oftentimes are more concerned about their political philosophy and advancing their political philosophy than they are interpreting the Constitution. So let's see what the Supreme Court has to say. They are the final arbiter. That's the way the Constitution was written. And they ultimately will decide just how much authority with regard to the tariffs that President Trump has. But this really is an issue about whether you like tariffs or not. It's about whether or not the president can exercise what he claims is his authority under emergency circumstance, which, you know, that's open to criticism, because how long does an emergency last? But these are all questions that the Supreme Court is going to have to evaluate.
I understand the legalities of it, but we do have to take into account of what impact it's going to have on the economy.
Not in this decision. The decision is, does he have the authority to do it? That's what the Supreme Court decision is about. Is it legal? And then that's another question, whether the tariffs are going to work. Well, there's a time when we didn't have a U.S. income tax. Our nation was funded by tariffs. So this is not, you know, necessarily a new thing. Biden used tariffs. The question is, to what extent does the president have the authority to use tariffs in the way that he is? And that's a fair question. That's an open question, and that's yet to be decided.
But where I agree with Mark is that it's about emergency powers, and it's and really what I'm hoping is for clarity on or at least some parameters about the use of executive orders to by fiat implement sweeping changes to policy and laws. And this absolutely affects tariffs because that's how we put the tariffs in. And if we're going to talk apples to apples, Mark, you got to say tariffs that were put in were put in the past with in conjunction with congressional actions versus this time, which is all through executive orders. But it also affects other executive orders that he's put in. I mean, Trump has come in with a slew of executive orders basically implementing elements of Project 2025 that should have gone through congressional review and vote. And frankly, I think Congress should have to vote. They should have to go on the record to say, yeah, we support this, that we support tariffs as a way of manipulating or controlling the market. That it's within their right. Okay, and what we're doing right now by sort of doing this wink and a nod between Johnson and the Speaker Johnson in the White House is that members of Congress aren't being held responsible to put their position on the line. So the people that we vote for to go to represent us aren't representing us because it's frankly they're not given an opportunity. And that's a fundamental shift in how the country is working. And Mark, you're right. Every single president wants more authority. And I think the difference I see today versus where we've seen in the past is that I think the use of executive authority, the use of executive orders, is so different and troubling to me that I don't know where we come back from, but. The Supreme Court's decision on this is going to have ramifications even beyond tariffs. It's going to get into the idea of the executive orders about the use of military, the blinding to posse comitatus. There's a whole host of changes that have been made in this country by the single signing of an executive order, which is not, in my mind, what the founders intended or what the democracy was intended with this balance of powers.
We are talking about the Supreme Court. We are talking about a case that the Supreme Court has fast-tracked that will be looking at the issue of tariffs. We just heard from Bob Griffin. Mark, you wanted to add a few words?
Well, I just think that people that they don't like the Supreme Court if they have decisions that they don't like. They're more supportive of the Supreme Court. We have to let the Supreme Court do the thing. It's not like it's easy to become a Supreme Court justice these days. I remember the votes typically were 98-2 and whatever. That those days are long gone, and there's so much vitriol in politics today, and it's all about destruction, trying to destroy the other guy, and that's frustrating. But ultimately, the Supreme Court has to decide on these things, especially on the executive orders, as you guys had mentioned. Are we going to, the blue state AGs are suing everything that Trump tries to do. So, you know, the litigation is only going to be increased. But ultimately, somebody has to, on legal issues, somebody has to make the final say, and that's what the Supreme Court's going to do.
Paul writes, Mr. Grimm, there is no need to take a swipe at the lower courts and suggest they are acting politically as opposed to legally. I trust their judgment to behave as they were trained, and if some of those rulings are against Trump's agenda, then they have a good reason to act in that way.
Yeah, I don't trust their decisions. I think they are more, in many cases, political, And that's a shame.
So you don't like their decision?
Well, some of them, yes. I think Democratic appointees have been more inclined to use to rely on political philosophy rather than the Constitution. Conservative judges, I think, are more constitution-oriented, that the basis of their conservatism. And I think you see that playing out in all of the courts.
I mean, but obviously by design, it seems to me it's obvious anyway, by design that this Supreme Court is a very politicized Supreme Court.
Why do you say that?
Well, because every decision is 6-3.
Yeah.
Well, then the three are politicized. I mean, you know, why are
the... Or the six are politicized.
You know, if the liberals all vote in a block, why they're not politicized? I mean, the reality
is... Republicans are also voting in a block.
Not always. In fact, Roberts saved Obamacare. And Amy Coney Barrett has issued some decisions that were not along with the conservatives. So the liberals on the Supreme Court vote more almost... always vote as a bloc. That's not the case with the six so-called conservatives.
My complaint with the Supreme Court is actually a little bit different. My complaint about the court goes back to Merrick Garland's potential nomination to the court and Mitch McConnell fundamentally blocking it, and then saying that he wouldn't do something similar, you know, that if there was ever a time where another Supreme Court justice passed away, that he wouldn't support it close to an election, you know, that he would do the exact same thing so that it wasn't a partisan, and then turn around and stuff the nomination through again. So I look at the court as frankly unbalanced because of the machinations of Mitch McConnell and the appointments.
Back to letters.
I'd also argue that the process has become so bad that all of the nominees hide behind the, well, I'm not going to. There's a term that they use to say I'm not going to answer your question. It might become before the court. Yeah. So therefore, I don't want to. It's not like the court's recusing himself. I mean, I think about the situations where, like, I think Clarence Thomas has enormous conflict of interests and hasn't recused himself. So I mean, I think the court has really some enormous ethical issues. I think the partisan issues certainly are in place. I actually have viewed in the past, even with more conservative justices, felt like the best interest was not partisan, but was in the best interest of the country. And I don't believe that this court has that. And I mean, just look at the findings of Citizen United and things like that. They have fundamentally screwed up this country. Mm-hmm.
We have letters. We go to Andrew. We have an illegitimate and openly corrupt Supreme Court. Why should we trust them? They are just as political. Then we go to Polly. We used to be able to rely on the Supreme Court to protect and preserve our Constitution. Oh, well, says Polly.
Can I just ask you, the listeners, why did they feel that way about the Supreme Court but not about lower court judges? Are they somehow vastly different people?
I think they're equally political, right? I think that the Supreme Court is just as political as the lower court judges. They all, take the same oaths to be, following the Constitution and are not supposed to be political. But everybody has opinions. Everybody is a human. And I think we're seeing this in action at the Supreme Court level because, a lot of them are Republicans appointed by Republican presidents. And now we're seeing them make rulings, that are aligned with Donald Trump.
That was Anna Markowitz on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 10th. We'll be back with more after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 11th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, a grants analyst based in Albany, Emily Honan, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Of course, the headline of the morning is the manhunt that is underway for the person who killed Charlie Kirk, the charismatic founder of the nation's preeminent right-wing youth activist group, in a brazen attack on a Utah college campus. No suspects were in custody as of this morning. And Mr. Kirk, a close ally of President Trump and the founder of a prominent conservative youth activist group, was shot while speaking to students at Utah Valley University. The FBI released the man its director had said was the subject of investigation. They actually had taken two people into custody that were labeled as a person of interest. And both were interviewed and then subsequently released a short time later. Meanwhile, just while we were, while the lockbox was going on in the last 10, 15 minutes or so, 10 minutes, there was a press conference that happened in Salt Lake City. And officials say they have recovered the gun that they believe was used in the shooting of Charlie Kirk. Robert Bowles is the special agent in charge of the FBI's Salt Lake City field office. He described it in a news conference as a high-powered bolt-action rifle. It was found in a wooded area where the shooter fled to after killing Kirk. Investigators also said during this press conference that they have good video footage of this individual. Bo Mason, who is Utah's public safety chief, says that officials will not release it while they are working to identify the suspect through facial recognition technology. If they are unsuccessful, he said, they plan to share his image publicly in an effort to identify him. He has been referring to the shooter as a man throughout the news conference, although no other information was given. Investigators have other evidence that could help them identify and track down the killer. The special agent said that evidence includes a palm imprint, a forearm imprint, and a footwear impression. Meanwhile, the suspect in the shooting appears to be of college age, and they say we are confident in our abilities to track that individual. This again from Bo Mason, the commissioner of Utah's Department of Public Safety, and saying that investigators have been able to identify the gunman in video footage taken yesterday. There was a comment made earlier yesterday during, I believe, the first press conference where they said they had surveillance footage, which was not of great quality. And since then, going through the neighborhoods, once the gunman was fleeing the scene, they do have better footage that they are investigating as we speak. So that's the latest on that situation. That gives you an idea of how the manhunt is going. But obviously, there is the overall issue as well of what is being called, certainly by the governor of the state of Utah, as well as the president of the United States, as a political assassination. Malia.
It's hard to know where to begin with this. So it's not the first political assassination we've seen in this country this year. We had the assassination of the Minnesota lawmaker just in June. Charlie Kirk, I don't know a lot about him, but I understand that he had his own security in addition to the security that Utah Valley University, is that
yes,
the name? Yeah,
yes.
Had on site. So clearly he knew that there were threats against him of some sort that perhaps were not that public. But there's so many facts about this that are really deeply troubling. that someone was killed. It seems clear it's a political assassination. I mean, there shouldn't be any. I don't think there should be any argument about that. Who did it and why? We can speculate. But if it's a political assassination, then generally that means you're trying to silence the person who committed this crime. Was trying to silence a voice that they didn't agree with, or they found was dangerous in some way. And the fact that it happened on a university campus too is just. In some ways, I feel like it makes it, as an educator, makes it worse. I mean, this is a place where you're supposed to be able to talk through differences, learn from each other. Bringing in someone as a speaker doesn't mean you agree with them. It means you're creating an opportunity for dialogue, and that, you know, as educators, we never give up hope that dialogue is possible, that learning can take place through engagement and interaction. And it's so antithetical to everything that a university stands for someone of college age who may have been a student there, or nearby, to commit a crime like this, silence a voice, in public like that. I mean, it's terrible on a number of levels, and that breaks my heart. And then also I'm concerned about, you know, what happens next. What are the reactions to this going to be? We've already seen some of the reactions in Congress and from the president. And I think it was the Utah governor who said in his speech, among other things, you know, reach out and hug someone. So there's a full spectrum of different kinds of reactions. But to have two political assassinations take place just within a couple of months in this country, it's obviously doesn't speak well to the state of our polity. How do I react to this aside from being heartbroken over it? It's, you know, I think it's important for us to continue to find positive ways to go forward. I feel even more like a stronger conviction about the importance of my own work as an educator, trying to bring people together. We can't throw in the towel and say, you know, Now it's a free for all, woe is us. I think it's really important that we not give up the principles that we hold for, you know, peaceful civic engagement, and just renew our commitment to that.
One of the things that struck me about this about Charlie Kirk is, and I certainly knew of him. I knew of his popularity. I knew that he was a major force on college campuses. The fact that what happened yesterday was, if someone who is on campus and is taking questions from people who don't necessarily agree with him. And there is a debate, and it is a healthy debate. Is it a show? Sure, it is. I mean, that's what it is, right? You come in and he is a podcaster, he is an influencer, but it is an opportunity for people to say what's on their mind and for him to respond. If that doesn't happen on a college campus, then where in the hell can it happen?
Right.
I actually am very familiar with Charlie Kirk. I've been following him for many, many years.
You were of that vintage.
I am. I'd like to first share a quote from my friend, which I think was my friend who's a trans man who lives in Florida. And I think it's a very good quote. Well, it's just kind of a feeling. They said, you know, political violence right now, I think, is a little too much on both sides. I don't want this to be the norm. I don't want to live in a country where this is the norm. And then he said, what? I don't want to live in this country for many reasons, but I don't really want to live in this country where political violence is a norm. I would like also to share a quote from Charlie Kirk from directly after the Minneapolis school shooting. I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it to have a cost of, unfortunately, some gun deaths every single year so we can have the Second Amendment to protect our God-given right.
And it's that that makes this all so murky, right? That we are trying to, I mean, look, I think we're all on the same page. No one deserves to be assassinated. No one deserves to be gunned down for their thoughts and what they say. If people do not agree with them, but I and that fact is just to me something that is troubling, because we seem to be losing that, and both sides are do amp up the rhetoric. I don't know what the solution to that is, other than it when something like this happens, you always think it's the opportunity that we can address it, and that never works out.
Yeah, you know, in some respects, you know, that I've seen a lot of comments from the left, you know, just pulling up all of the kind of hateful things that Charlie Kirk said, and then talk about all the other bad things that happened yesterday. There was a school shooting, but you can't underestimate the importance of Charlie Kirk to young conservatives, to the Donald Trump presidency, to how he motivated people. And I don't see any need to make him a hero. I don't seem, but I think the moment for us now is to discuss political violence and how wrong it is. Imagine all of, like, I think there were 3,000 people in that audience yesterday.
Yes.
All of those people underwent that kind of trauma. And now, with that video that millions of people have seen, I mean, the videos from that are horrific. I would encourage people to take their time and let the news develop. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't jump on the fray of, you know, this is a truly human tragedy for Charlie Kirk and his family and all the people who loved and, you know, admired him, but also for us as a nation, because we are going to a very bad place. What we need is for every one of us to acknowledge that this is wrong, that people should be able to speak their mind, to engage in debate, even if what they are saying is horrific, is something we really do not agree with. But let them talk and let them. I mean, I think one of the things Kirk did was try to debate people. He was really good at it, and he always won each debate. I mean, every back and forth, I've seen him slap down people with, you know, sometimes wrong logic. But he was an important part of the Trump administration and what's happening. I think discussing where that movement goes from now is going to be interesting, because there's nobody like him.
31 years old.
Yeah.
Two young children, a wife. And that just gives it a human element, that he's not a monster. He's not someone whose head spins around. He is a real person who goes to parks and goes to ball games and brings his kids to school in the morning, and while, again, as Judy just said, is for people who do not certainly find what he is saying disagreeable, there is a way to counter that and a way to, as I said, and to have a forum in a college. It just strikes me as the place that those conversations should happen.
I think that what a lot of people also have been saying is that this is a symptom of the rhetoric that's been preached in this country for the past year. And it's frightening to see that, you know, it can come back and do this to people who even spoke about this as if it was something that should be expected in the country, and it shouldn't be. You know, people shouldn't have to sink to these lows to make waves, to make changes. This shouldn't be the norm. But unfortunately for many people, it it almost is. I mean, you just mentioned that we had the assassination of Melissa Hortman and her husband in her home, you know, not even 2 months ago. That hasn't even settled. I feel like with the news cycle these days, these things just keep going and going and going. It gets replaced by some other tragedy. You know, I've seen people talking about, you know, how long is this going to last? How long until the next big tragedy happens? And everybody focuses on that and this fades into the background. And I'm not sure. I don't know if this is going to prove to be something different from our what our news cycle has become. But it really is. It's frightening. It's frightening at its core. And what, like what my friend said, it's just sort of another sign of the country descending into something lower.
And we're going to take a break. But I mean, the one thing I did want to mention, too, is you both have mentioned those who were killed. But, you know, you even look at the horrific Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who as his family was sleeping in the first night of Passover, someone went to the residence and set off two Molotov cocktails and threatened that entire family. And thank God nobody was hurt. But again, another example, further example of political violence. Given your military background, Malia, I will ask you about this, but the weapon that was used, I mean, the one thing about this, the other aspect of it is, I mean, we can get into the security part of this too, which is that for the 3,000 students, there was no security check going in. People were not screened going in. It was an outdoor event, so that, of course, would have made it more difficult, but that was the case. And then also of the officers who were in addition to Charlie Kirk's own security, which we don't know how many people yet that included, it was six people. And that's not very many people to be monitoring 3,000 people who are out there, especially with a gunman on a roof, allegedly, at this case. Tell me about the weapon, and also, if you can, just how, I mean, every map I've looked at, that shot is really far away. I mean, that does tell us something about the person who's doing it, that you would have to be trained to be able to pull that off.
Yes. But I don't think that's very unusual in Utah. So the weapon you mentioned is a bolt action rifle as opposed to a shotgun, for example.
Yes.
So a shotgun shoots pellets or shot and it sort of scatters, whereas bolt action shoots a round that, I mean, it's more it's designed to kill or maim someone or something. I think Utah is one of the states where, I mean, it's an outdoor state. There's a lot of hunting. There's a lot of federal and state lands, and it's pretty common for people there to have weapons, have access to weapons, and so it doesn't necessarily surprise me that that a bolt action rifle was used. Clearly, the to pull this off, the person had to have planned this out. They knew enough about the event to know where they were going to have line of sight to where the speaker was sitting. They had planned ahead of time to find a place where they could have that line of sight and not be interrupted. I mean, unlike in the movies where some assassin shows up and, like, you know, sets themselves up and they're in and out in 30 seconds, that's not what I would expect was the case here. They probably needed to, you know, set themselves up and find the right moment. And then they knew what their escape route was going to be. So there was clearly a plan in place for all this. Sorry, what was your other question?
No, I guess it was about security.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how you keep a group secure? And
yeah.
And are we at a point, I mean, given the rise of political violence, and you touched on this earlier in your remarks, that, you know, he knew that there were threats against
right.
him, obviously. And yet this was the
yeah.
this was the plan agreed on between his camp and the university.
Right.
And they went forward with it. But I think any of us who have gone to, I mean, I've been security checked at book readings. So, like, you know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah. So it's a little bit, I mean, since he had his own security, I mean, ostensibly, I expect that if Charlie Kirk had wanted there or had insisted, you know, I'm only going to do events where there are screenings, then the screenings would have been set up. And for whatever reason, it wasn't set up in this place. I'm not sure. I don't know if it's a capacity issue or not.
But screening but wouldn't have helped.
It
anyway.
Wouldn't have helped.
It wouldn't
in
have
this
helped
case.
In this case. And it's true that, you know, on most college campuses, and I don't know what the laws are in Utah, but in a lot of places, I mean, the security or the police on college campuses, I mean, it varies widely from, you know, large universities that have their own police forces, some of whom actually carry weapons, to smaller institutions that have, I mean, they're all very capable, well-trained people, but on a lot of campuses, the officers don't carry weapons, and they're there more for, you know, crowd control and general safety and security and to, you know, remove
drunk freshmen.
Right. So things like that. And they're, I mean, most college campuses are not prepared to guard against, you know, assassin rifle bearers.
That was Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 11th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, September 12th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Joseph Palamountain, junior chair in government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, and senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond.
The breaking news as we've been on the air since just before 9 o'clock and was officially announced less than a half hour ago, that a suspect has been caught and identified in the Charlie Kirk shooting. Governor Spencer Cox of Utah said a family member of the suspect, Tyler Robinson, helped turn him into authorities after Robinson indicated he carried out the killing. That follows the president of the United States speaking on Fox and Friends this morning and saying, "I think we have him." All of that to go and bring you up to date. Obviously, we'll have much more on this as it becomes available, and certainly we'll be covering it during Midday Magazine coming up at noon today.
Can I?
Yes.
Very brief kudos to Governor Cox. I think that the statements, the way he's talked about this, his measured statements have been very, very impressive. I hadn't, you know, don't recall hearing him before, but I think he's handled a very difficult situation in a very measured and great way.
It is, and has really been sort of the voice of this, the official voice of this throughout the press conferences and so forth. We have letters. I want to get to as many of these as we can because we asked you for them and you sent them and we might as well read them. Okay. Let's see. G says, I'm really tired of the phrase, this is not us, meaning that in America, this is not how we act or do things politically. Well, this absolutely is us. Some examples are Medgar Evers, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That from G. Then, I think you were making that point earlier,
correct.
Bo.
Yeah.
Karen says, your panelist who just said that 40% of Democrats endorse violence to remove Donald Trump. Who is he quoting and what is the context of that statistic? This cannot be right and it should not go unchallenged.
Yeah, so it's the guy's name is Robert Pape, P-A-P-E. He runs an institute at the University of Chicago that studies political violence. And he has been studying this for 30 years. He was on, actually, NPR this morning about an hour ago. He's all over the New York Times. But look up his study. Robert Pape, 40% of Democrats, 25% of Republicans, and so on. It is, from what I can tell, it is a solid, credible study.
Yeah, I that number struck me too, and I wondered how the question was asked.
Yeah, polling right. is very slippery.
Right.
But and those two, it was supporting violence to remove the president, supporting the National Guard to suppress protests, or was it to enforce against crime? Either way, those
suppress
aren't
protest.
Necessarily mirror images of each other. Like
right.
they're
right.
No.
So right. I
no.
But
no.
That I.
Also, I mean,
at the risk,
so,
though, one second, at the risk of angering my fellow panelists, we tend to go down
too
those.
Late, Bo.
Yeah,
it's
sorry.
Too late, Bo. I let it slide the first time, but I appreciate the writers.
Generally, we tend to criticize the study. There is an uptick. I think
yeah.
you both would agree. Bill, you said it. There is an uptick in our willingness to think about violence as a way to dissent.
To talk about thinking yeah. about, yeah.
yeah. I don't disagree with that. I just wondered when you said that data point the first time, I wondered what's behind it, what was the question, how was it asked, and the comparison. In the previous letter, one of the things, you know, this is not who we are. The other thing that I'm sick of, you know, it's not the guns. It is the guns, folks. It is the guns. So, in any case.
One thing I will say about
yes.
polling, one more thing.
Yep.
Don't get me going on polling.
You asked the question.
You are on fire this morning. I like this. This is great.
Would you support violence to remove President Trump? If you don't like President Trump, even if you're not really inclined to violence, right. you might say that as a way of signaling that you don't like President Trump. So the question itself, and now, if they're asking exactly the same question over a period of years, and the response goes up, then fair enough. But Trump has only
been in
office.
It's a loaded question.
They must have, because that's not the question, folks. That wasn't the question that Robert Pape asked, right? And the way we know that question, I don't know, Robert Pape from a hole in the wall, and I'm here defending him, is that he said the number has doubled since
right.
Over the period of time in which he has studied it, which is some longitudinal distance.
Well, I wouldn't doubt at all that 40% of the Democrats would like him removed from office, but it's the violent part that I question. That's the part that it seemed, you know, I don't know.
I got the data from the New York Times, so I'm assuming.
Not questioning the data, but the I do think. I don't know what to what Bill was saying. I mean, I know how I would react to that. And once I heard the word violent, I would be out. Once
right.
I heard violence, I'd be out.
Out, right.
You know, do you support removing this particular candidate? Yes. Do you support doing this through violent means? No. I do wonder, but getting caught up in it, I don't know. Let's go back
letters.
To letters. Thank you. E writes, is that right? Yeah. Trump spews rage, anger for years, stoking division in this country, and now we are divided people. Are we or a divided people are surprised at the violence, I'm really not surprised at all. Well, this is to Beau's point earlier. There's always been violence. Yeah. We've always had violence.
This is one thing that's very different about our current situation is that the elected leader of our country, when given the opportunity to try to tamp things down and try to reconcile the fighting factions in our country, he goes exactly the opposite direction.
Right.
Like, I mean, I can't say I've read every speech he's given, but like he's never given a speech where it's like, now people, we need to get along. Like, that's just not his style. And
No. And
that is like past presidents, that has been an absolute rule among presidents, that when there's a fraught situation, the president comes out and tries to calm things down. And it's often frustrating to their own supporters. Right. Like it's often they're saying something that their own supporters don't want to hear, but it goes with the job. And that's a job that Trump just does not, you know, he's not willing to do.
He uses it as a tool. And now how did we get to January 6th? Right.
Yeah. Listen to this, folks. Now, all of a sudden, I sound like I'm this like devotee of Robert Pape. He was on. I'm not. I never heard of him before yesterday. Right?
A papist. Yes.
But
the papacy. It is.
Listen to this. One of his studies suggests, Bill, in response to your answer, that the key to getting past this really fraught moment is for there to be joint statements between Republicans and Democrats. So Trump and Schumer should get up there and do a joint video. Now, I think his study is right. That to me strikes me as a little bit outlandish to think that people would do that. Democrats and Republicans would get together on a video, or B, that would make any difference. That's what he's saying.
There was actually a statement, I think it was like young Republicans and young Democrats in Connecticut, I want to say, they put out a joint statement saying, this is horrible, we don't support violence, you know, Charlie Kirk didn't deserve this. There are examples of that. It's just that they're not happening at the highest levels of our government.
Right. And the Problem Solver Caucus, the Democrat and Republican got on and talked about it. But what happened right after 9/11? One of the most moving moments where all these members of the House and Senate went to the Capitol steps and they started singing the God Bless America. Is that right? Yeah. And
the equivalent this time was the Speaker of the House called for a moment of silence, which I guess lasted for about 30 seconds. And then as soon as that 30 seconds was over, they started screaming at each other.
Right, because one of them wanted to pray out loud on the floor and the other day. But so it does happen. There are moments where Republicans and Democrats come together and at fraught moments. But I think that for the last decade, this leader has used this a tool as one of the key tools in his toolbox is to create these wedge moments, wedge issues. That's what he knows.
And, it's his superpower.
And here we are to divide people.
I do want to mention that the Beau touched on this, but Robert Pape was a guest on Morning Edition this morning, and you can hear that online by going to NPR.org. Michelle Martin interviewed Robert Pape, so don't go blaming Beau. You can hear it from Mr.
directly
Pape.
From him,
Professor Pape himself. All right, a couple more letters, and then we'll take a break and then move on here and finish up for this morning. You're all talking ad nauseum about political violence when you don't even know who the shooter is or what his motivation was. Far more salient is the fact that the FBI is led by a far right nut job with no law enforcement experience who has fired or ousted many of those who do, including the former head of the Utah branch of the FBI. Every governmental institution meant to protect us, including the military, has been degraded, demoralized, and misused. We are not safe from any kind of violence. So I agree with most of that letter, except for the part about, talking about political violence when you don't even know who the shooter is or what the motivation was. I mean, I think it is safe to say it was a political assassination. The person was obviously wanted to silence that voice, and so I think there's much more to be said and there's much more to be learned, but we get a sense of what the motive was, and that was to silence that voice.
Quick comment about that, the second part of that.
Yes.
Because I agree too, Joe.
Yes.
I'm with you on that. I'm with the writer on that. I will say this is the we continually see the repercussions of appointments by the presidential administration based not on expertise but based on media savvy. And I've said on this show many times that the Pete Hegsets of the world and the Cash Patels of the world were picked because they are charismatic in front of a camera. That is not the way you run American politics.
Well, and loyalty.
In addition to being charismatic, I don't know about the charisma of Cash Patel, but they're picked because of for being edgelords.
Fair. That's fair.
They're picked for being willing to say edgy things that land in favor of the MAGA position.
Right.
And that's like it doesn't have anything to do with qualifications or whether their temperament is right for the job. In fact, I would argue that an edgelord should have no role whatever in law enforcement, but that's I agree that the president is not picking the right people in a lot of cases.
And I think they're being picked because they're fealty to Trump, right? Their allegiance.
Loyalty is a big thing.
It's his thing. But I mean, what I was trying to talk about at the beginning was what I think this writer's getting at, which is we are in this country, there is a rise in violence domestically. We have a lot of domestic problems domestically. We have economic problems. We have a whole host of problems. And then globally, I'm deeply worried about what happened in Poland, what's going on in Gaza, all around the country. But they are weakening our ability to address those problems and to keep us safe. And that's why I was trying to talk about what's happening in the Justice Department, what's happening in the FBI, what's happening in Health and Human Services across the board, the weakening of our federal infrastructure to address these range of issues, our education system and on, to respond, I think, is a serious problem. Look at the lawsuit that was filed the other day from three high-level FBI officials who were fired and how they outline the politicization of the FBI.
I want to read the four letters that we got a ton of letters, but of the ones that we chose to represent this morning. We'll get to those four. We'll take a break, and then we'll finish up. Bill writes, perhaps what is missing is awareness. I don't mean more information or knowledge. Being aware of how addicted we are to being right. With awareness, one can then have thoughts and not just react. With awareness, we can allow others to think what they think and not be so reactive, and then communication can occur. That's a very interesting, well-written point. I just assume I'm wrong about most things. I think that's just I don't have this like I'm right, and I just assume
there should probably be some kind of daily prayer that we all say where we remind ourselves about logical fallacies.
Yes, but, yeah. I just
have empathy for the other's views and the other's situation.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 12th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.